Network needs your help.
Modern Bible scholars teach that the church will miraculously be kept from the tribulation in an event called the rapture. Yet the Bible is strangely quiet about such an event. The Watchman's Cry is a fascinating new book by Obadiah Frank that makes the study of the last days understandable. Using clear explanations, the notion that the church will be raptured before the time of the Great Tribulation is proven a dangerous deception. The Watchman's Cry is available from the American Freedom Network for only $10 postpaid. Call 1-800-205-6000.
This is Dr. Stan, our guest this morning, and Mr. Daniel Mahoney. We're going to be talking about a book that he and another gentleman had written about Solzhenitsyn. It's a fascinating book about a fascinating individual. Mr. Mahoney, are you there?
I am here.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And what motivated you and your friend to write this book about Solzhenitsyn?
Well,
why is Solzhenitsyn important?
Yeah, we're co-editors. It's a kind of commented anthology of Solzhenitsyn's writings. Both Ed Erickson and I had written extensively on Solzhenitsyn. Ed had published two books on Solzhenitsyn's thought. I had also published a book in 2001 called Solzhenitsyn, The Ascent from Ideology, that tried to draw out the positive features or dimensions of Solzhenitsyn's thought and writing. Both Ed and I were struck by the fact that so much of Solzhenitsyn's writings, both earlier writings, writings that allow us to understand how Solzhenitsyn arrived at his mature convictions, and many of his most important later writings, especially his monumental cycle of works on the Russian Revolution, The Red Wheel, as well as many other writings, had not appeared in English. In fact, the United States has been way behind the Germans and French and others in translating Solzhenitsyn in recent years. So, and in addition, I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about Solzhenitsyn that in part are related to the paucity of publication of some of his more recent works. So you'll often see editorialists or essayists commenting on a work like The Red Wheel without having read it. So Ed and I decided that it was about time to put together an extensive volume of Solzhenitsyn's writings. Our volume, The Solzhenitsyn Reader, New and Essential Writings, 1947 to 2005, includes something like a third new materials in English, and it's a big, big book. So, we had full cooperation from the Solzhenitsyns, who were very supportive of the project from beginning to end.
And it is a beautiful book, and you'll actually see parts or maybe chapters out of some of his most important works that have been translated into English. You just won't find any place else. In fact, his work on the Soviet Union, the Russian people and the Jews, is something that people have talked about, but nobody's ever read.
Well, that's right. I mean, the book has appeared in German and Italian and French translation, as well as the original Russian. And there were some very intelligent essays that appeared about the book, especially Volume 1, when it appeared in 2001. In prominent American magazines and the TLS and places like that, but it's never appeared in English. So that's one thing we were able to do is reproduce some core chapters from that work to at least allow an Anglophone North American readership to read what Solzhenitsyn has to say and not have to rely on press reports, some of which are not always very accurate.
Usually not very accurate.
Yeah, especially when it comes to Solzhenitsyn. I like to say I can't think of any outstanding intellectual figure in recent times whose work has been so systematically distorted and misunderstood.
Well, I think it's important that people understand that Solzhenitsyn really started out embracing communism, this utopian dream. Wouldn't it be wonderful if a man could just bring utopia to the world, and and everything will be controlled by the people? And he really started out as a communist, didn't he?
He did, and that's one of the reasons why we're so excited about being able to reproduce some of his early writings from the camp period, from prisons and camps, where Solzhenitsyn wrote 12,000 verses without the benefit of pen and paper, including an autobiographical work we've excerpted called Doroshenko, The Way or the Trail. And in this work, you can see how Solzhenitsyn, the communist, under the shock of arrest and imprisonment, was forced to reconsider all of his first principles. And in the course of about 5 or 6 years, Solzhenitsyn moved from a position of dogmatic Marxist-Leninism to eventually toward a Christian affirmation. But it was a process of self-discovery and self-criticism, and really being forced to confront the true nature, the monstrous character of the kind of utopian politics you speak of. By the way, one little anecdote your listeners might be interested in. In the beginning of the trail, Solzhenitsyn reports that as a young man, right after he got married, at the age of 21, he got up every morning on his honeymoon early so he could read excerpts from Das Kapital. You know, this is right before the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. But the young Solzhenitsyn was an enthusiastic Marxist-Leninist.
And, of course, really what a terrible thing it was, even when he was released from prison, he wasn't allowed to go back to be with his wife. He was exiled, so he could never see her again.
No, that's right. I mean, the complicated story, because they were divorced while he was in prison, because literally there was active persecution of anyone who was married to a political prisoner, and Solzhenitsyn was afraid that she'd be arrested or that her life would be ruined, so he gave her permission to move on with her life. Although in 1957 they did meet up again and remarry, and they were divorced in the early 1970s, and Solzhenitsyn's been married to his present wife, another Natalia, since the early 1970s, and they've been married now for 36 years, and that's been a much happier arrangement than the second Natalia Serova. Solzhenitsyn is a very much an intellectual and spiritual and familial partner with Solzhenitsyn. But yes, the camps wreaked havoc on people's lives, and including their family lives. Separated families tore marriages apart, created untold psychic and spiritual devastation, as well as the loss of freedom and millions of people's lives.
And of course, his only crime was he'd written a letter, to somebody being critical of what was going on in their society.
A very veiled reference to Stalin in a letter to a high school buddy who was also in the army.
We'll be right back here at the American Freedom Network.
Constitutional Moments are brought to you throughout the day through the generosity of CNC Prototype Machine, Boulder, Colorado. Insulin, Our Silent Killer, is a new book written by scientist Thomas Smith. In this self-help manual for diabetes and other blood sugar handling problems, you will learn the true cause of this disease and, more importantly, what you can do about it. Insulin, Our Silent Killer is available from the American Freedom Network for only $25 postpaid. Call 1-800-205-6245. It's extensively referenced with helpful tables to learn what foods are good and which ones are not. This is a must-read for everyone.
Bill of Rights, Article 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Article 2. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed.
Pure drinking water is essential to a healthy life, and everyone using the British Birkfield and Berkey series of water filters will benefit by adding the PF4 reduction elements to their system. The PF4 works to help absorb MTBE, fluoride, lead, and arsenic, as well as DBCPs, THMs, and various pesticides and herbicides, and heavy metal ions. A set of four PF4 filters are available for only $85 plus shipping and handling. Call 1-800-205-6245.
Hi, this is Danny Golden. If you heard my show last week, you heard my guest, Norm France, author, lecturer, and international Bible teacher, talk about the paganism that has blatantly infiltrated our modern holidays. Due to the positive response of that show, I've asked Norm to be my guest host this Friday, the 22nd, to discuss the other war on Christmas. Tune in this Friday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Norm will be taking your calls and answering your questions.
Well, Dr. Stan here, and our guest this morning, Daniel Mahoney, and he had written a book with Ed Erickson, The Solzhenitsyn Reader, a fascinating book, a very large book. But, of course, if you like Solzhenitsyn, here you're going to read the things that you won't read elsewhere. And of course, this amazing man, you know, like so many of our intellectuals today, really believe in the all-powerful state. This is what they teach our university students, this is what they teach in our schools. Oh, we have to have this world all-powerful government that can regulate everybody's lives so we can be free. And unfortunately, that is not the way that it works out, as Solzhenitsyn found much to his horror when he saw what the life was like in the Gulag. And then, of course, how did he ever actually get his books published? I thought that was such a fascinating explanation, because ordinarily within the Soviet Union, I mean, you could not publish anything that was critical of the government. He initially went to prison for 8 years, as I remember, simply because in one of his letters he had some veiled reference to Stalin. It was a private letter he sent to somebody else, but you see, in the Soviet Union, they monitored everything.
No, that's right, and in fact, there's a wonderful chapter from a memoir of Solzhenitsyn's called The Yoke and the Calf, I think one of his most compelling books. The chapter we've included in The Reader is called The Writer Underground. Solzhenitsyn describes, after a period of 8 years in prison and 3 years in exile, he became a school teacher in central Russia, in a very isolated part of Russia. This became the basis for one of his most beautiful short stories, Matryona's Home. In any case, Solzhenitsyn describes a long period of time in which he simply wrote for himself and wrote for posterity. He would very scrupulously hide his manuscripts with no expectations that they would be published in his lifetime. And eventually what happened was that Nikita Khrushchev had given a famous speech at the 20th Party Congress of the Soviet Communist Party in which he criticized Stalin. He didn't denounce communism, he didn't denounce totalitarian dictatorship, but he criticized what he called the cult of personality, the excesses of Stalinist rule. Solzhenitsyn had a book called One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, one of his two or three most famous works. We didn't include it in The Reader because it's a short novella and readily available. In any case, Solzhenitsyn took a chance and sent this to a Soviet literary magazine, Novy Mir. They wanted to run it as part of this anti-Stalinist campaign. They sent it to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev really didn't understand the book. He thought it would be sort of useful in exposing some of the excesses of the Stalin period, and he failed to see that it was a deeply and profoundly anti-communist book. It was published. It was the only one of Solzhenitsyn's major writings published while he was still living in the Soviet Union before 1974. It was published in 1962, and immediately Solzhenitsyn became a world-famous writer. This was the first and only fundamental challenge to the communist regime, the first and only book that told the truth about the camps, even if Solzhenitsyn had to veil it a bit, that appeared in Russian during the Soviet period. And very shortly thereafter, the regime made very clear that Solzhenitsyn wasn't free to publish again. Well, by that point, it was too late. Solzhenitsyn was, as I said, a world-famous figure, and many of his most important writings were snuck out of the West, snuck out of Russia to the West, and published in translation overseas and in underground in Russia. There was a, in the Soviet Union, I should say, there was a network of self-publishing called Samizdat, where people would type long books, circulate them. Of course, they did so at their own peril, but many of Solzhenitsyn's most important writings circulated through this Samizdat network in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. So even though Solzhenitsyn could not be officially published, his writings were widely read at home, and they certainly were available in translation in many languages abroad.
I thought the point you made about the when the book went to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev would ask many of the people on the Politburo what they thought of the book. Now, the book already was more or less critical of Stalin, and so you know, and the gulag that Stalin had established. So the Khrushchev would ask people their opinion of the book. If they agreed with the book, then, of course, they agreed with him. If they disagreed with the book, then, of course, they disagreed with him, and that was sort of a means by he had of knowing who was his friends and who was his enemies.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's not, it's true, and in addition, you might say this. One reason One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, this very beautiful book, a very powerful, damning expose of communism, saw the light of day in the Soviet Union was because people on the Politburo were afraid of disagreeing with Khrushchev. And so you might say communist habits of conformity and uniformity allowed this book to, you know, sneak out, led the Politburo to authorize its publication. And it is interesting that somebody like Khrushchev couldn't appreciate that in the end Solzhenitsyn represented a very different way of approaching the world. That book has a very sympathetic portrait of Alyosha the Baptist, who's one of the most attractive characters in the book, and obviously his model of Christianity is profoundly un-Soviet. In addition, later writings of Solzhenitsyn make clear, especially his magisterial Gulag Archipelago. This is, I think, the most powerful book Solzhenitsyn ever wrote, a beautiful book. It's a part autobiography, part historical analysis, part philosophical meditation, part historical narrative of the camp system. But in that book, Solzhenitsyn made clear that the Gulag system began not with Stalin, but with Lenin. That from the founding moment of the Soviet regime, the system was dedicated to terror and tyranny and totalitarianism. That a systematic effort was made to persecute Christians and aristocrats and bourgeois and anyone who was considered to be an unperson or enemy of the people. So I think one of the reasons what Khrushchev didn't appreciate was that Solzhenitsyn's target was not the accident of Stalinism, you know, the cult of personality around Stalin, but the very nature of Marxist-Leninist ideology. In a great passage in the Gulag Archipelago, Solzhenitsyn says it was thanks to ideology the 20th century saw death and suffering in the millions and tens of millions. And, you know, Solzhenitsyn clearly saw the culprit as Marxist-Leninist ideology, its utopian, totalitarian ideology, the illusion that men and societies could be remade at a stroke. That was the problem, not the personality of Stalin, not, you know, because that's based on the illusion, oh, if only Stalin had been nicer, if only Stalin had been less cruel, somehow Soviet communism might have led to something more productive, more constructive. And that was the illusion that Solzhenitsyn challenged.
And, of course, you know, there should be a lesson in the writings of Solzhenitsyn for America today. I mean, first of all, because, you know, his contention was that these things came to Russia because they forgot God.
That's right. And one of Solzhenitsyn's most important speeches, so we've included in the reader many speeches and essays by Solzhenitsyn, but Solzhenitsyn was awarded the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion in 1983, and he went to London and gave a great speech, the Templeton Prize address, and he begins by saying, in the end, the fundamental lesson to be learned from totalitarianism, the totalitarian episode, the cruelties and injustices and the mass murders that flowed from totalitarian communism, is that men have forgotten God. And Solzhenitsyn thought that while totalitarian communism was the most extreme version of that forgetting God, that men had also forgotten God in a more subtle but ultimately devastating way in the West, too. Solzhenitsyn certainly admires the freedoms and the rule of law and the constitutionalism of the Western tradition, but he also knows that there's a temptation in the West. Solzhenitsyn, in his Harvard address, the controversial but I think very powerful Harvard address of 1978, calls that temptation anthropocentric humanism, man-centered humanism, what some people might call secular humanism, the idea that our freedom is rooted in our own will, in our own absolute autonomy, rather than freedom being liberty under God and the law. And I think Solzhenitsyn's a very eloquent defender. Some people think because Solzhenitsyn challenges secular humanism, anthropocentric humanism, that this makes him an enemy of democracy. But in fact, Solzhenitsyn is trying to remind us that true democracy, true freedom is rooted in a recognition of the sovereignty of God and not the sovereignty of man. And that's a lesson, I think, that helps account for why liberal intellectuals in the West were so at first ambivalent and then increasingly hostile towards Solzhenitsyn.
And I think it's such an important point. Freedom is not the ability to do whatever you want to do.
That's right.
Freedom is the ability to do what you should do according to God's law. And only those people who can govern themselves can truly be free.
That's right. And Solzhenitsyn always reminds us that while there's, you know, and in fact, we're very proud of some of these new writings of Solzhenitsyn where he talks about the importance of local self-government. He speaks about his admiration for the town meetings in New England. He puts a lie to this charge that he's anti-democratic. But at the same time, Solzhenitsyn reminds us, I think as you nicely put it, of that other side of self-government. Self-government is not only individuals participating in the political process, it's also responsible and free individuals limiting themselves. In essay after essay, in writing after writing, Solzhenitsyn talks about the importance of self-limitation. There can be no freedom without self-limitation, because otherwise freedom becomes an invitation to a new form of despotism. And again, a lot of Solzhenitsyn's critics, when I sometimes call his culture despisers among the intellectuals, they confuse Solzhenitsyn's, I think, very measured defense of self-limitation with an invitation to coercion or authoritarianism. Or sometimes they pull the what Solzhenitsyn calls the Persian trick, you know, and they accuse him of being a Russian Ayatollah, you know, supporting theocracy. Solzhenitsyn has never said anything in favor of theocracy, but he wants freedom to be rooted in a recognition of an objective moral order. He wants freedom to be, he wants people to recognize that true freedom is connected to self-restraint, self-limitation. And again, too many people confuse this with authoritarianism or theocracy. It couldn't be further from that, but that's why I, you know, at the beginning of the interview, I spoke about the dishonesty of some of Solzhenitsyn's critics, the refusal to make these elementary distinctions. And unfortunately, Solzhenitsyn has become a kind of symbol in the culture wars. You know, those who want to promote a more relativistic, even nihilistic conception of freedom inevitably distort what Solzhenitsyn has to say on these matters.
Yeah, I'll never forget when Solzhenitsyn wrote an article for Foreign Affairs magazine, and he talked about the 60 million people who had perished in the Soviet archipelago and in the gulags. All the letters written in condemning him for saying that, well, he was simply quoting something he'd read in the Washington Post. That was their figure, the Washington Post figure. But the liberal intellectual cannot accept that. Oh, well, it was only a few million people, as if somehow only a few million people was far better than 60 million people.
Yeah, you're right. I well remember that essay. It was called Misconceptions About America, Russia Imperil America.
Right.
And it was quite startling to see the academic experts and journalists and others who wrote in either nitpicking with Solzhenitsyn or not taking seriously two of his fundamental messages. One was exactly what you spoke about, the record, the demographic record, the human consequences of communist tyranny. Many of them wanted to sugarcoat communism. Many of them wanted to understate the number of people who were killed, etc. Another message that Solzhenitsyn talked about was the need to distinguish between Russia and the Soviet Union.
We'll be back in just a moment with Mr. Daniel Mahoney, and we'll be talking about the Solzhenitsyn reader. Tell you how together.
Speaking with Jamie LaRue of Windsor National Mortgage, 970-686-6866. Jamie, does a debtor need perfect credit?
Because the VA backs these loans, lenders do not require perfect credit. Sometimes just good payments on rent, utilities, and phone bills is all that's needed.
So veterans, learn more about your benefits. Call Jamie at Windsor National Mortgage, 970-686-6866.
An emergency preparedness plan for your home, car, school, and office is a must. Knowing how to store water safely, survive extreme temperature changes, provide reliable shelter, first aid, and sanitation is critical. Knowing where to get the best lights, radios, and other supplies is easy. Ferris Survival, located at 3366 South Broadway, is a professional, reputable, full-service business providing realistic preparedness supplies at affordable prices. Stop by, go online, or call 303-781-0343, 866-781-0343.
The Kelly Healing Arts Center, located in Fort Collins, provides exceptional individualized natural health treatment plans utilizing the best in natural therapies. If you are looking for quality health professionals that will listen to your needs, give honest advice, and provide quality health care, then call 970-223-7425. Again, 970-223-7425. To learn more about the Kelly Healing Arts Center, go to kindermedicine.com. Discover the best of what natural medicine has to offer.
If you're looking for a dependable, reasonable, and honest customer service, you're looking for Josiah Electric, LLC. Hi, this is Michael Pohl, owner of Josiah Electric, a licensed and insured commercial and residential electrical service with 9 years' experience serving the Wyoming, Nebraska, and Denver metro area. Contact us Monday through Saturday at 303-489-2170. That's 303-489-2170. Josiah Electric, service you can be sure of.
We're talking today with Tom Phillips, founder of The Green Herb. Tom, what makes The Green Herb different?
First is our health analysis. I know of no other company that will take the time necessary to suggest an in-depth herbal program especially for you. And we do it at no charge or obligation. Also, we manufacture all of our products right in the Wheat Ridge facilities. This way we can assure you that you're getting the highest quality products available. Last is our guarantee. If you don't think our products are the finest, most potent herbal products available, just return the bottle and we'll exchange it or refund your purchase price. We can do the analysis at The Green Herb, over the phone, or online at www.thegreenherb.com. Call today and set an appointment for your free health profile at 888-765-HERB. That's 888-765-4372. Or come by our store on the north side of I-70 Frontage Road, 1 mile west of Kipling.
Well, Dr. Dan here at the American Freedom Network. Our guest this morning, Mr. Danny Mahoney. We're talking about the book, The Solzhenitsyn Reader, and how can people get copies of your book?
Well, I've seen it in quite a few Borders and Barnes & Nobles and some independent bookstores. It's also readily available from Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, and also our publisher, ISI Books. If they do go to the ISI Books webpage, they can Google search it, and they can order right from the publisher. So that's another option, too.
All right, fine. It's an excellent book. And if you like Solzhenitsyn, you'll love this book because you get a chance to read so much of, you know, of what he said, you know, that you're not going to read in English because it's just never been translated. And you almost have to ask why it's never been translated into English, because he was very, very popular, you know, in our country, and many of his books were widely read. Why do you think it is that no publisher has just gotten around to writing his, for instance, his treatise on the Russian people and the Jews?
Well, it's a great question. I think part of, by the way, I should add, Solzhenitsyn has a two-volume memoir on his life in the West called The Little Grain. It's appeared in Italian and German and French as well as Russian, not in English. Solzhenitsyn spent 18 years in the United States. This would be a bestseller, Solzhenitsyn's memoir in his years in America, and yet it still hasn't appeared in English. So it's quite curious. I think the New York publishers, Solzhenitsyn's books sell, so they would make money. I think it's ideological.
I think the New York publishers, they've
come to believe these distortions about Solzhenitsyn. A publisher like HarperCollins, even for R. Strauss and Giroux, they made millions and millions of dollars off of Solzhenitsyn's books, and yet they have not really gone out of their way to publish his more recent writings. I think the ideological issue is real. I also think there have been some issues with translation. It's hard to find good translators. One thing we were able to do with this reader is we brought together a team, two of Solzhenitsyn's sons, Ignat and Stepan, who did beautiful translations and really conveyed us what a good writer Solzhenitsyn is. I think some people who like Solzhenitsyn's ideas don't sufficiently appreciate that he's a splendid writer. So we've got pieces in here, these prose poems he's written, these beautiful spiritual meditations, and some of his short stories, some of his early, his camp poems. They're very evocative and beautifully written works. And so I think that comes out. But we were able to put together a translation team, two of Solzhenitsyn's sons and two other scholars, Professor Alex Klimov from Vassar College and Mike Nicholson from Oxford, who are just beautiful translators and very dedicated to Solzhenitsyn. But these publishers, you know, a publisher really needs a little bit of that inspiration. They need that sense that, you know, they're not committed to an author unless they think it's worthwhile. They're not going to take that extra effort to find the translators, to make the books available. And now, on the case of the book on Russia and the Jews, I think people didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. There was a terribly unfair charge. But some people have, accused Solzhenitsyn of anti-Semitism, even for writing such a book.
Of course, it isn't not an anti-Semitic book in any way, is it?
It's not at all an anti-Semitic book. In fact, Solzhenitsyn Solzhenitsyn goes out of his way to say Russians have to come to terms with the injustices committed against the Jews, especially under the imperial old regime. He goes out of his way to say neither the revolution of 1905 or the revolution of 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, were Jewish revolutions, the product of a Jewish plot. He attacks that view as false and destructive and irresponsible. He says Russians have only themselves to blame for the terrible events of 1917. On the other hand, Solzhenitsyn says both Russians and Russian Jews have to come to terms with those among their compatriots who collaborated with Bolshevism, who reinforced that terrible regime. So he calls, as he always does, for repentance and self-limitation, for a kind of constructive dialogue, for a kind of coming to terms with the mistakes of the past. And it's a thorny subject. It's a subject many people don't want to talk about because it raises, no one really, like in Russia today, very few people want to talk about the complicity of so many people with the communist regime of the past. So it's, in any case, I think because some of Solzhenitsyn's more irresponsible critics would accuse him of many things. You know, he'd be called a czarist and a theocrat and an imperialist and an authoritarian and sometimes an anti-Semite. Some of these publishers, I think, simply assumed that a book on Russia's Jewish question by Solzhenitsyn must be an anti-Semitic work. In fact, it's a deeply morally serious work. It's a historical work informed by the best scholarship. Solzhenitsyn is too great a writer, too decent a man, too serious a Christian ever to succumb to the evil of anti-Semitism.
And I think that's really what of course, keeps him from being anti-Semitic is because he is a Christian.
That's right. And that's why Solzhenitsyn says that no decent person, no Christian can tolerate the oppression of the Jews or the reduction of the Jews to something less than, participants in our common humanity, et cetera, et cetera. So Solzhenitsyn could not be more emphatic on that theme.
Well, anyway, it's a really beautifully written book, and you have a lot of his poetry. I don't think most, or at least his prose that most people have never even heard, and a lot of the short stories have never been really widely popularized.
No, I think that's right, and some of my favorites are, you mentioned two of my favorites, the poems from Prison, Camp, and Exile. Just absolutely, we have three of them, as well as an excerpt from that autobiographical narrative poem, The Trail, that I mentioned earlier. But one of these poems, Prisoner's Right, Solzhenitsyn discusses in a very beautiful way his the lessons he learned in the camps. Another poem, Akathistus, Song of Praise, is about his return to Christianity from Marxism. Very, very beautiful poem. And you may know Solzhenitsyn had cancer and was told by the doctors in 1951 he had 2 weeks to live, 1952, 2 weeks to live. And in 1952, he wrote a poem, Death Not as Chasm, in which he reflects on the sad fate of Russia, the terrible events of his time in light of his impending death. And, of course, 54 years later, Solzhenitsyn is still alive.
Doctors aren't always right.
What's that?
Doctors are not always right.
Well, that's right. So, but that poem is particularly poignant because Solzhenitsyn expected to die very shortly, and he miraculously survived and just had his 88th birthday on December 11th.
In fact, didn't that inspire him to write the book, The Cancer Ward?
That's correct, because he spent time in a cancer ward, and of course he uses this image of cancer as a kind of metaphor for the Soviet system. And the same image in the it's an important image for him in the Gulag Archipelago. Solzhenitsyn speaks about the metastasization of the camps, how this principle of tyranny spread its first germs with Lenin, and how this archipelago spread like cancer throughout the Soviet lands. So the cancer experience was very important for him, and it's funny, with prison and arrest and gulag and cancer, Solzhenitsyn never lost his faith in God, his confidence in divine providence.
Amen to that. We'll be back here. When we get back, we'll take your calls, 970-689-8255. 970-689-8255.
Tapes of the preceding show are available by calling 1-800-205-6245, the American Freedom Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tom Phillips, founder of the Green Herb.
All of God's people have a ministry, and it's a trick of our enemy to keep God's people sick and worn out to hinder their ability to minister. We are often judgmental toward people who are addicted to booze, cigarettes, and drugs. But we at the Green Herb have found that most of God's people are unknowingly addicted to the two most addictive products in America, sugar and soda pop. If you have a sickness or disease, or if you're just tired a lot, the Green Herb has an herbal product that is formulated just for you, and it's just $15.95. Come by the Green Herb, located in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, on the I-70 Frontage Road North, 1 mile west of Kipling, or call 888-765-HERB, that's 888-765-4372, or go to our website, www.thegreenherb.com, and be sure to listen to The Green Herb Show with Linda and Dr. Cass every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on KHNC.
I just started my own business, and I had no idea how many details there were. Then someone mentioned insurance. Almost forgot that little detail. Luckily, I heard about a new plan from Humana called Humana One HSA. Humana One HSA combines a health savings account administered by Chase and FDIC-insured bank with a high-deductible health plan. So I get medical coverage I can afford, and I can save money for my health expenses tax-free. I could save between 20 and 40% on my health premiums, and I'll reduce my taxes. I applied over the phone and talked one-on-one with Neil Muhlberg, a Humana representative. He helped me set up both my health plan and my savings account. That's what I call simple and smart. And when you work for yourself, you've got to think smart about your business and your health insurance. For more information and a quote, call Neil Muhlberg, an authorized agent for Humana One, at 303-499-2735. That's 303-499-2735. Application is subject to acceptance or approval by insurer. Health plan has limitations and exclusions.
Well, Dr. Stan, back here at the American Freedom Network, our guest this morning, Daniel Mahoney. We're talking about the Solzhenitsyn Reader. Ed Erickson and Daniel Mahoney wrote the book. Our telephone number, 970-689-8255. If you have a question on this book or on this amazing story, this amazing man who actually came here to America and lived for 18 years. He was actually up in Vermont. He actually had a chapel built on his farm there, didn't he?
That's correct, yes, yes. And sometimes a visiting Orthodox priest would come and do the Divine Liturgy, yes. And Cavendish, Vermont, which is a very nice little town in the center of Vermont. And Solzhenitsyn was very well treated by his neighbors, and they respected his privacy, his desire to write. But his sons, who are wonderful young men, not so young anymore, they're in their 30s, but they were educated in Vermont and very much part of the community. And Solzhenitsyn twice addressed the town meeting, once when he first came and once when he was leaving in 1994, and gave a beautiful text in which he both expressed appreciation to his neighbors but also expressed admiration for their way of life and for their sturdy traditions of local self-government. And we included that Cavendish farewell in the reader.
Why did Solzhenitsyn return to Russia?
Well, he had always said that he would return to Russia when all of his books could be published freely, and when he was free, when he was free to work again and contribute to the public life of his country. And after the fall of the communist regime in 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union, it took him sometimes, he wanted to finish his great work, The Red Wheel, his multi-volume work on the causes of the communist revolution. He finished that, and they packed up their bags, and he had the family, they flew from to Alaska, then to Vladivostok, and then they took a train through Siberia to Moscow, stopping in all sorts of villages and towns and talking to ordinary people about what was going on, and then they eventually settled right outside of Moscow. So he wanted to go home. He's a patriot. I like to say, you know, he wanted to breathe the Russian air, but he wanted to do so in a country where his works were available and could be read.
But of course, we're seeing increasingly in Russia today the descending hand of tyranny, when reporters who are critical of the regime are assassinated or suicided or something of the sort, and opponents are poisoned, and this is not uncommon at all. Increasingly, why Russia's turning away from these countries?
Well, you know, I have to say, I think the Western press has been very quick to. Let me back off for a second. Solzhenitsyn's view is a little different. I mean, he too is concerned about some recent developments in Russia, but he wasn't a big fan of what was going on in Russia in the 1990s. He always said Russia needed to escape from communism.
Right.
But how she escaped from communism was all important. And Solzhenitsyn thought of the 1990s, with the rise of a kind of criminal oligarchy and a new kind of oppression and a kind of unrepentant communist party, that what happened in the 90s was not really democracy. It was a kind of ordinary people suffered as the members of the old communist party enriched themselves, became the new capitalists. So under Putin, there was some restoration of order and some cleaning up of that criminal oligarchy. Some of that was necessary. The question, I think, today would be whether or not the country is, as you said, drifting in authoritarian direction. I think some of that is overstated in the Western press, but I for example, don't think Putin was behind the poisoning of Litvinenko. You know, many people don't know, Litvinenko died a Muslim. He had Chechen connections. He was also very tied to a pretty unsavory oligarch in exile named Berezovsky, and he had connections with the Russian mafia, so it's not so clear who was responsible for this. But I do think it's really incumbent on the Russian government to come, they have to show deep seriousness about investigating these kinds of crimes, because otherwise people are going to assume that when a journalist like Politskaya, who was killed last November, gets killed, we don't know who did it. They're going to assume that if the government wasn't behind it, they tolerate those kinds of things. So I think it's a real test for Russia over the next couple of years, whether or not the government is willing to protect broad public freedoms, and whether it's willing to seriously investigate these kinds of crimes. I do caution, though. People sometimes think, oh, everything was wonderful in the 1990s and Russia had democracy and now it has authoritarianism under Putin. If you read Solzhenitsyn's Russian Collapse, which is included in the Reader, the work dating from 1998, Solzhenitsyn makes clear Russia didn't have very much freedom in the 1990s. It had this kind of, an unprecedented kind of corruption, where people were amassing, trillions of dollars. Where some of these oligarchs, they were just old Communist Party officials who rebaptized themselves capitalists and took over the factories, took over the economic structures. So Russia has a lot of work to be done, but I'm not so worried about either a return to communism or the emergence of some kind of fascist regime in Russia. I think things will be a lot better in Russia, but it would be a mistake to call Russia today a tyranny. I think it's... time will tell, but I think it's incumbent on us on the West to be wary and to make clear to the Russians that we want to see basic human freedoms respected, or else, Russia won't be an accepted member of the European community or the broader European community.
Of course, Russia today is rising as the major oil producer in the world, major producer of natural gas. Russia is, accumulating reserves. As America squanders ours.
That's true. And again, it gives, even though Russia's losing population, in some ways Russia structurally, isn't in a position to be a great power. It's 140 million people. It doesn't have, but the oil power does give Russia considerable say or influence in international deliberations today. I think that's quite true. I want to say this about Russian foreign policy. A lot of people see, it is true Russians have been more assertive the last two or three years, and part of that has to do with the their oil and natural gas resources. On the other hand, there's not an ideological dimension to Russian foreign policy today. They're not trying to promote an idea like communism.
We'll be we're out of time. Thank you so very much for being with us, Dan. We really enjoyed having you.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
I'm Ann Johnson. For over 11 years, I've owned a health food store. I'm an iridologist, herbalist, and perform extensive muscle testing to find out what products best meet my customers' health needs. That's why I'm so excited to tell you about Vital PSP. It consistently surpasses over 3,000 samples in my test kit. My customers are having amazing fast results. Vital PSP has profound effects at DNA levels. If you struggle with any health issues, I recommend you call me, 303-833-2784.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution.
If catastrophe struck, would your family be prepared? Are you confident you wouldn't react in a panic? Is there one place to get all of your emergency supplies? Ferris Survival encourages you to have confidence through preparation, not panic through crisis. Harris Survival, located at 3366 South Broadway, is a professional, reputable, full-service business providing quality, realistic preparedness supplies at an affordable price. Go online, stop by, or call 303-781-0343. Ferris Survival. If catastrophe struck, would your family be prepared? Are you confident you wouldn't react in a panic? Is there one place to get all of your emergency supplies? Ferris Survival encourages you to have confidence through preparation, not panic through crisis. Ferris Survival, located at 3366 South Broadway, is a professional, reputable, full-service business providing quality, realistic preparedness supplies at an affordable price. Go online, stop by, or call 303-781-0343. Ferris Survival.
Well, this is the time when I do need to remind our listeners that my ministry is primarily listener-supported, and if you're out there and you agree that we have an unusual message, then maybe we have a little different grasp on what's going on, because we really believe there's secret societies out there. We believe that there is a satanic force behind communism, but it's the same satanic force that is guiding the Council on Foreign Relations. And if you ever go to the Council on Foreign Relations headquarters at 68th Street, and you can get in there, as I have on a number of occasions, you'll find right next to the desk where the librarian sits, because they won't let you go anyplace but the library. There they have a copy of their magazine, Foreign Affairs. They keep it under glass with a constant dull light on it so you can see it. It's the copy of Foreign Affairs that Lenin wrote in the margins. You see, the people at the Council on Foreign Relations really love and respect Lenin, because he was a ruthless, tyrannical dictator who wanted a world government, and that's exactly what they want. They want a one-world system under their control where everybody is subservient. That's why, for instance, here in America today, you will never hear any mention of the 41 to 43 million people who were intentionally starved to death in China between 1958 and 1962. How do you suppress, in a country, a free country like ours, knowledge of the Great Hunger? They refer to it as the Great Hunger in China. They usually refer to it only as about 30 million people. Books written about it, like The Hungry Ghosts, but you're not going to hear it in America, because our media is controlled for the same reason that they don't translate Solzhenitsyn's books into English. They don't want you to read them. They don't want you to know about the Great Hunger. They don't want you to understand we are financing this tyrannical regime in China today. But we're going the same direction. We have more people in our prisons today than they have in prison in China today. How could that be? Because there are evil and wicked forces in America. We've turned our back on our concepts of freedom. We now have the Military Commission and John Warner Defense Authorization Act that allow the president, encourage the president, according to Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, to establish a military dictatorship in America. Only, of course, when they precipitate, or if we should have a national emergency or an epidemic or perhaps a natural disaster or civilian unrest. We've done away with the Posse Comitatus laws. They have actually put out $38 million to refurbish the Japanese concentration camps, the 10 of them, where they put 121,000 American citizens who had never committed a crime, who many of them were loyal Americans born here, but because they had slant eyes and yellow skin, they put them in concentration camps, and we're refurbishing those camps now, just at this time in history, because we don't want to forget how terrible it was. But then, if it was so terrible, why did they give Halliburton $385 million to build new detention camps? And why are many of the old army camps out here? Only they've changed the barbed wire, not to keep people out, but to keep people in. Ladies and gentlemen, they're planning a dictatorship here in America because the leaders of both political parties are controlled by the same dark spiritual forces that work through what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you have not read my book, you need to get it. You can get it by calling 1-800-544-8927. Get what we have is the 911 special, 5 DVDs that will tell you what happened on 911 being used as a vehicle for a dictatorship in America. 1-800-544-8927. Bye-bye. Until tomorrow.
Want to talk to the American Freedom Network? Contact us at P.O. Box 1750, Johnstown, Colorado, 80534, or online at AmericaNewsNet.com. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Pure drinking water is essential to a healthy life, and every